KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I think it's stupid to welcome people into their country that are going to go to your universities as visitors to start a riot.
The Secretary of State is defending the administration's decision to cancel many international student visas.
For Tuesday, April 22nd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This hour, we'll look more closely at an attack in Gaza where Israel killed 15 emergency workers.
Also, arguments in a Supreme Court case over religion and parental rights in schools.
And Joan Didion's final book is out years after her death.
Didion spent so much of her life guarding against catastrophe. One just feels the colossal force of this calamity entering her life.
Plus, what if you got a tattoo with the promise it would disappear and it didn't?
Would I have still gotten this tattoo if I knew it would last this long? Honestly, probably not.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The White House says President Trump will visit the Middle East next month. NPR's Deepa Chivram reports the trip will include stops in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates.
The trip will last a few days in mid-May. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt says the president's trip will be an effort to strengthen ties between the U.S. and those countries in the Middle East, and he'll take part in bilateral meetings. Saudi Arabia has been a key player in negotiations to end the Russia-Ukraine war. Last month, delegations from the U.S., Ukraine, and Russia all met in Riyadh to discuss steps toward reaching a ceasefire. Saudi Arabia was the first foreign country Trump visited in his first term. It was meant to be Trump's first foreign trip of this term, but now the president will head to Vatican City this weekend to attend Pope Francis's funeral. Deepa Chivram, NPR News, The White House.
Representative Robert Garcia of California says he and other lawmakers made good progress on the release of Kilmar Abrego Garcia during a recent trip to El Salvador. Garcia's been held in El Salvador in prison since he was sent there by the Trump administration last month. Democratic lawmakers saying, when we met with the U.S. ambassador in both classified briefings and other conversations, we made the case that we are very clear about our intentions to continue pressure there. Elon Musk says he'll limit his time with the White House's cost-cutting efforts starting next month. As NPR's Bobby Allen explains, it comes after Musk company Tesla posted worse-than-expected numbers for the quarter.
On a Tesla earnings call, Musk said establishing DOGE within the federal government is mostly done and that he expects to soon work just a day or two per week on White House matters. Musk, the executive of Tesla, has been operating as a special government employee, allowing him to work for 130 days in government. But his future in the White House beyond that has always been unclear. President Trump has supported the efforts of Musk, but his hard-charging approach defying norms and procedures has frustrated others in the administration. Still, Musk said he plans to be involved in government in some fashion for as long as Trump allows. Musk's announcement came as Tesla reported that its quarterly profits have dropped 71%. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
The International Monetary Fund, in its latest forecast for global growth, is projecting significant slowing, with almost all the blame being laid at the doorstep of the Trump administration and its tariff fight with other countries. IMF Chief Economist Pierre-Olivier Gouin-Chous today cited confusion over the policy.
Beyond the abrupt increase in tariffs, the surge in policy uncertainty is a major driver of the economic outlook. If sustained, the increase in trade tensions and uncertainty will slow global growth significantly.
The IMF is now predicting the global economy will grow at just a 2.8% rate this year, down from the previous forecast of 3.3%. Stocks jumped in a widespread rally today, recouping some of their losses from yesterday. The Dow was up more than 1,000 points. The Nasdaq rose 429 points. This is NPR. Supreme Court has signaled a majority of justices appear willing to support the religious rights of Maryland parents who want to remove their children from elementary school classes using books with LGBTQ characters. The case centers on the Montgomery County school system in Maryland, where conservative justices appear ready to side with some parents who sued the school system after it stopped allowing them to pull their children from lessons that included the books. School board had introduced the storybooks as part of an effort to better reflect diversity in the district. Twice a year, Record Store Day encourages fans to hit their local stores in search of exclusive titles and rare reissues. NPR Stephen Thompson reports the event has made its presence felt on the Billboard charts.
Independent record stores around the world took part in the most recent Record Store Day, held April 12th. Now a dozen Record Store Day titles have cracked the Billboard 200 albums chart. Some titles hitting the chart, like a picture disc vinyl edition of a Fleetwood Mac album from 1975, contained no new music. But others packaged live performances or added B-sides. One album, Post Malone's Tribute to Nirvana, put a streamed performance on vinyl for the first time. Tribute to Nirvana enters this week's Billboard Albums chart at number 106. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices followed stocks higher today. Oil was up $1.23 to settle at $64.32 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Culver City, California. Palestinian officials say nearly 140 rescue workers have been killed on the job in Gaza during the war. The Israeli military has not investigated many of these killings, but one attack last month that killed 15 emergency workers sparked a rare high-level inquiry. NPR's Aya Batraoui takes a closer look, and a warning: this report includes the sound of gunfire and descriptions of war.
On March 23rd, just days after Israel ended a ceasefire in Gaza, Israeli troops opened fire on Palestinian paramedics and emergency workers. Video found on one of the dead paramedics' bodies shows what happened that night. Ambulances and a fire truck with flashing emergency lights on travel down a dark road in southern Gaza. It's not yet dawn. The video is shot by paramedic Rifat Radwan, who's riding in one of the ambulances. He films the emergency crews approaching another ambulance on the side of the road. They see bodies. They get out of their cars wearing red reflective clothing. Then, for the next 5.5 minutes of this video, Israeli troops fire on them. Radwan is heard praying to God. And he asks his mom for forgiveness, saying he was only trying to save lives. Israeli forces are heard shouting something in Hebrew at the end of the video before it cuts. It wasn't until this video was unearthed on a phone with Radwan's body by other Palestinian rescue workers days later that Israel reversed its original statement that the emergency vehicles had approached soldiers suspiciously without headlights or signals on. The public airing of the video prompted a military investigation, which released its findings over the weekend. It says the shootings were mostly the result of a, quote, operational misunderstanding, but also identified some professional failures and breaches of orders. That explanation isn't enough for those who knew the medics.
These were medical workers from Palestinian Red Crescent Society and the civil defense, and I'm still in their uniforms, still wearing gloves. They were killed while trying to save lives.
Jonathan Whittle leads the UN's humanitarian response in Gaza. He recorded the UN's mission into southern Gaza to recover the medics' remains.
This is Romeo 1. I'm just going to check to see if there's any human remains in here, just so wait out.
The 15 bodies were found in a mass grave. Israeli soldiers buried them there and bulldozed the ambulances into the sand. The military says burying the bodies this way was reasonable under the circumstances and not an attempt by soldiers to conceal what happened. They say crushing the vehicles was wrong. The Palestinian Red Crescent says the military's investigation conceals the truth. The UN's Whittle has urged greater accountability. And at a briefing earlier this month, he said this about the killing.
Because I think it's really emblematic of the point that we've reached in Gaza. What is happening here defies decency, it defies humanity, it defies the law. It really is a war without limits.
A war without limits. That's the message critics say soldiers on the ground are hearing from their leaders. In a video circulating online and aired on Israel's Channel 14 News, the commander of the Golani Reconnaissance Unit, whose troops killed the paramedics, tells them before last month's ground offensive, anyone we encounter is an enemy. We identify a figure, we eliminate it. He says this is how to free Israeli hostages still held by Hamas in Gaza, a message echoed by Israel's leadership. The commander's deputy was dismissed after the investigation. The military concluded he ordered troops to open fire due to a sense of threat and that he didn't recognize them as emergency vehicles due to poor night visibility. NPR reached Munzer Abid, a 27-year-old paramedic who survived the attack. There's only one other surviving paramedic. He's detained by the military. Abid says he was blindfolded and interrogated for 15 hours before being let go. He says, thank God a video emerged proving Israeli claims were a lie. He says the truth came out clearly to the world, showing how his colleagues were killed. The military has since taken over most of southern Gaza and is expanding control over more territory. Aya Botrawi, NPR News Dubai, with reporting by Anas Baba in Gaza.
The State Department is revoking international student visas over alleged campus activism. But universities report the cancellation extends far beyond these cases, with many other students now facing deportation. Many students tell NPR their visas were canceled without explanation, raising questions about the true scope and scale of the government's crackdown. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
In early April, this undergraduate student from India received an email out of the blue from administrators at the Georgia Institute of Technology, telling him,
"My visa was revoked on 6th of March, 2025.
Like all of the students in this story, he asked to be anonymous. The students fear being detained and deported by immigration officials and penalized while looking for jobs in the U.S. He thinks his visa issues date back to a traffic incident from last year where he says he was falsely accused of driving under the influence.
The case has now just been completely dismissed. Charges have been dismissed. I've been acquitted.
He'd come to the U.S. last year to study computer science.
For someone who's never been there and from an Asian country who always grew up there, the U.S. is kind of like one of the best countries in the world. I would love to live there.
But now he's unsure if he'll be allowed to continue his studies, and even if he can, if he wants to stay in the U.S. According to a tally from the publication Inside Higher Ed of Public Announcements, over 240 universities have reported more than 1,500 students have had their visas suddenly revoked in this manner, many over minor alleged crimes. These figures likely include some of the 300 or so people Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. revoked visas for due to campus activism. Here's Rubio justifying the move.
I think it's stupid for any country in the world to welcome people into their country that are going to go to your universities as visitors. They're visitors. And say, I'm going to your universities to start a riot.
The State Department said in a statement to NPR that when revoking visas, they look at arrests, criminal convictions, and other conduct, quote, inconsistent with the visa classification. NPR spoke to and examined the legal cases of more than three dozen international students who had their student visas revoked in March and April. None say they were active in campus activism. Their lawyers say none had ever been convicted of a crime. Some, like this student from China, had faced minor charges once, but all charges were dismissed.
My criminal lawyers say that even though my cases was dismissed and sealed, the federal government still can see like all the records in the past.
And then in at least one case NPR examined, the student says they never had run-ins with the law, and they have no idea why their visa was pulled. Most of the cases NPR reviewed concern Chinese citizens. Others are Taiwanese, Indian, and Iranian. It's unclear whether Chinese students have been disproportionately affected by these visa revocations. China is America's biggest geopolitical competitor, but also one of the biggest sources of international students. The Department of Homeland Security told NPR in a statement these visa revocations are, quote, nothing new and is part of long-standing protocol and program. And students typically have 10 days to self-deport.
I grew up in mainland China. I didn't know what's democracy, what's freedom of speech, but I knew that they were in the United States.
This student decided to do her PhD in the U.S., but is facing deportation now over a dispute 2 years ago with her then partner. She said she called the police herself because she feared for her safety, but she was charged, though those charges were dismissed. She's asked we even distort her voice because she's scared of retribution for her political views if she's forced to return to China.
I can't study,
and I can't do my research because I'm scared. What if ICE comes to my home? What if ICE knocks on my door?
She says she's in shock and not able to sleep well. When she heard President Trump threatened deportations on the campaign trail last year, she said she was disappointed, but not scared for herself at the time. She never expected students like her would be targeted. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
In 2021, a company announced a new kind of temporary tattoo, one designed to fade after 9 to 15 months. Ephemeral Tattoo is the company, and it was perfect for Raimi Isofano.
Someone who knew that they did not want a permanent tattoo ever.
Isofano says tattoos are cool, she's just not a long-term commitment kind of girl. So a few years ago she thought, what's the worst that could happen?
Little did I know that almost 3 years later, my silly chicken on a skateboard tattoo would still be on my upper arm.
Ouch. Emily Kager got her ephemeral tattoo in 2022. She's the proud owner of two dogs, Shaggy Golden Doodles. And she thought, why not get one in space with an astronaut and let's even throw a few stars around them?
I actually didn't even see the final design until the day of, which at the time felt fine because I wasn't expecting it to stick around forever.
And yet, Kager's space dog is also still around almost 3 years later. She says she recently had to cover it in a foreign bathhouse where exposed tattoos are not permitted.
While not every customer has tattoos that stick around so long, hundreds have posted about their experiences on Reddit and TikTok. In 2023, Ephemeral Tattoo said that for some people, the made-to-fade tattoos can last up to 3 years.
In a statement today, the company acknowledged the disappointment of some early customers and says it has since improved the ink in order to reduce fade time variability. Meanwhile, Raimi Isofano says her chicken still skating.
I feel like it's part of me. I even named the chicken on a skateboard. His name is Maurice.
Not exactly what she imagined, but she says it's also become a reminder to not take life so seriously.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Scott Detrow.
Life changes fast. Life changes in the instant. You sit down to dinner and life as you know it ends. The question of self-pity.
Those four short lines, read there by Joan Didion during a 2005 interview with NPR's Susan Stanberg, mark the opening of her memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking. The book chronicles Didion's grief in the year after her husband, John Gregory Dunn, collapsed and died at their dining room table in December 2003. At the time, the couple's only child, Quintana Rue, was fighting for her life in a nearby hospital. Quintana would recover but would end up dying less than 2 years later after a series of related illnesses, all made worse by her long struggle with alcohol. Didion explored that loss and her relationship with her daughter in the book Blue Nights, which was published in 2011.
Well, as a writer, the first thing you think of doing when you don't know what you don't know what to think about something or what you're going to say, and so you work it up. I mean, that's the phrase. You get the information.
Blue Nights, along with The Year of Magical Thinking, combined to form something of a canon of Didion's grief, a canon that has resonated widely and deeply in the years since the two were written. Didion died in 2021, but now there is another entry in that collection of work. Notes to John is a collection of detailed reports that Didion wrote about meetings with her psychiatrist during a time that she described to a friend as a rough few years for her family. Didion's longtime editor, Shelley Wanger, found the notes in Didion's office.
I didn't come across them until after Joan had died, and the literary trustees were in her apartment. There are three of us, and that's when we found them. That was 2021.
What was your first response?
These look very interesting, like nothing we'd ever seen before.
I spoke to Wanger, as well as the publisher of Alfred A. Knopf, Jordan Pavlin, about the discovery, as well as their decision to publish Notes to John.
Jordan Pavlin, what to you is the value of this document in book form? Why publish these notes?
Well, in my view, Notes to John sits on the shelf beside The Year of Magical Thinking and Blue Nights, and it illuminates the wrenching losses in those books with haunting clarity. Quintana's illness and her death feel quite mysterious. Mm-hmm. And in Notes to John, Didion fills in those blanks and gives us a very clear picture of Quintana's battle with alcoholism and the degree to which her body had been compromised over a long period of time.
This book makes it clear just how much Joan was actively thinking about that. It seemed like every single day, just kind of struggling with how to help her daughter, when direct intervention was helpful, when giving her space was helpful, just constantly thinking through, am I doing the right thing? Am I being as helpful as possible?
This is a mother in anguish.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to ask both of you this question, and Shelley, I'll start with you. Joan Didion is somebody who, as we all know, shared so much of her personal life in her work. There's a moment in the documentary, The Center Will Not Hold, where she directly addresses this when she's asked a question about whether she and her husband ever worked out an understanding of what was off limits, what wasn't, for their work.
You used your material. You wrote what you had. And that was what I happened to have at the moment.
But she did it in this very polished, intentional way, and there has been some criticism of the decision to publish these notes. How are you responding to that?
Well, I think what is so fascinating is that they are like a complete document, and they also touch on these subjects in a way that's both sensitive and incredibly interesting, and They're not horrifying in any way. They are a wonderful read. And also, we felt that it was important to do a book because otherwise people go into an archive and nothing is restricted in this archive. It's all open to anyone. You might have people slightly taking bits and pieces and misinterpreting it. So it seemed really much better to publish it as a whole and bring it forth as a book.
And Scott, can I jump in here? It's Jordan.
Please.
I mean, just to be direct, I think the question that many people have asked is, would Didion have wanted this work published?
Right.
And the truth is, we can't know. But we do know that she kept a meticulous record of her life's most monumental battle, which was the struggle to save the life of her child, and that she preserved this record with great care in chronologically ordered pages. And she left the material in an extremely well-organized file cabinet beside her desk, where she most certainly knew that it would be found.
Did you ever think, like, well, maybe she would have just directly said something to us if she wanted this published? Was that a conversation among you and the other executors?
No, that kind of, there wasn't that kind of conversation about anything. You know, Joan and John kept these amazingly organized files. There were many in their apartment and downstairs in the basement. And they obviously, they knew what was in everything, and they saved everything. And so I think that Joan would just assume that these organized files were something that would go into her archive. Mm-hmm. And there was no need to say, oh, I don't want this published or that. That was never a conversation.
As I read notes to John, I was flipping back and forth and simultaneously reading Blue Nights. And you're right, there are several sessions where Didion writes through things that she and the doctor were talking about. And you can almost see a few chapters that parallel and expand on those thoughts. I'm wondering, we've talked about the writing style. We've talked about how this was reflected in her work. Did either of you learn anything about Joan Didion as a deeply worried parent from these notes that you didn't know before?
But one line that struck me with particular force, I just found this heartbreaking. Toward the end of Notes to John, she says to her psychiatrist, I thought I was on top of this. And one feels that she's not only speaking as a parent here, meaning I thought I was on top of my daughter's illness, but as a human, as a writer, Didion spent so much of her life guarding against catastrophe and against existential shipwreck. And one just feels the colossal force of this calamity entering her life and the recognition that she was not, in fact, on top of it.
That was Knopf publisher Jordan Pavlin, as well as Joan Didion's longtime editor Shelley Wanger. Notes to John is out today.
This is NPR News.
Pope Francis was the first pontiff from South America, and because of that, he formed a strong bond with Latino Catholics, including in the U.S.
I feel empowered in a way because he is okay with going against the traditions.
We'll hear why Pope Francis was both a spiritual leader and a major political actor who took a stand on divisive issues tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In Seattle recently, what sounded like the voices of famous tech billionaires started coming out of crosswalks.
So basically, anybody who's been recorded and is a semi-public figure is vulnerable to this type of fakery.
A deepfake crosswalk hack after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. There were more congressional visitors to the Maryland man the Supreme Court says was illegally sent to a maximum security prison in El Salvador. Congressman Robert Garcia of California saw Kilmer Abrego Garcia in El Salvador. He says the case involves profound issues of due process.
We are in an incredibly serious moment where you have a president defying a Supreme Court order, and that's bigger than just Kilmer or an immigration issue. This is about due process, that every person in the United States deserves due process under the Constitution, regardless of whether they are a citizen, a temporary resident, a student on a visa. Everyone deserves that right.
The Trump administration says Abrego Garcia was a member of the gang MS-13. More than a dozen Senate Democrats have signed on to a letter demanding a status update from Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth regarding transgender service members. As NPR's Elena Moore reports, the letter calls for Hegseth to explain how the Pentagon is complying with federal court rulings blocking President Trump's attempt to ban transgender troops from serving in the military.
The letter was drafted by Illinois Democratic Senator and veteran Tammy Duckworth. In it, she criticizes Trump's executive order and says that any effort to deny military service, quote, based on ideological grounds, is inherently un-American. She also asks whether any transgender troops had been prematurely dismissed due to the attempted ban, and what steps have been taken to bring them back. It's unclear whether Secretary Hegseth will reply. In a statement to NPR, a defense official said the agency's policy is to communicate directly with elected officials regarding official correspondence. Elena Moore, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow gained 1,016 points, closing at 39,186. This is NPR. After U.S. financial markets recouped much of yesterday's losses, President Trump said he had no intention of firing Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, despite hints earlier in the week that Trump may if Powell does not cut a key interest rate. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences says next year's Oscars ceremony will take place March 15th. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports the organization now has a few new rules.
To be eligible to vote on the finalists at next year's Oscars, Academy members will be required to watch every film in the nominating categories. Until now, they've only been encouraged to do so. The Academy will monitor which films voters see on its online screening platform or ask them to specify if they've watched them elsewhere. According to the new rules, the Academy will also take into account how much generative artificial intelligence and other digital tools were used to make films that are competing. Filmmakers with refugee or asylum status will be eligible to compete in the international feature film category, and for the first time, casting directors will get their own Academy Awards. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Elon Musk says he'll dedicate more time to Tesla starting in May after the company reported a big drop in first quarter profits. Tesla reports quarterly profits fell by 71% to $409 million. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet on Earth Day and every day through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Culver City, California. At the U.S. Supreme Court today, the conservative majority seemed more than ready to tell public school districts that they must allow parents to pull their kids out of certain classes because the course material conflicts with the parents' religious views. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
At the center of the case is the school system in Montgomery County, Maryland, with 160,000 students of almost all faiths. Beginning a few years ago, the county adopted a curriculum for elementary school students. It was aimed at promoting respect for LGBTQ parents and their children by including storybooks with gay and lesbian characters. Some parents, however, objected and asked to opt their children out of classes where the books were included. The schools initially tried an opt-out plan, but found it was a logistical nightmare. The religious parents sued the school board, claiming that the board was violating the Constitution's guarantee to the free exercise of religion. The school board won in the lower courts, but at the Supreme Court today, the board got little love from the court's six conservative justices. Leading the charge for the religious parents was lawyer Eric Baxter, who got a grilling from the court's three liberal justices. Justice Sotomayor pointed to one of the books that's objectionable to some parents, a book called Uncle Bobby's Wedding, about a girl who goes to her uncle's wedding to a man.
So what you're saying is that the exposure of children to the fact that two people of the same sex are getting married is coercion?
Baxter's answer was essentially yes. That prompted conservative Justice Alito to observe that the book has a clear moral message.
It's a message that a lot of people who hold on to traditional religious beliefs don't agree with.
Liberal Justice Kagan followed up, asking what rule the court should adopt. Are you saying that any time a student confronts something their parents disagree with, they can opt out of a class? Baxter repeatedly declined to say where he would draw the line, prompting this from Kagan.
There's a rule that applies as well to a 16-year-old in biology class. The parents say, I don't want my child to be there for the classes on evolution or on other biological matters which conflict with my religion.
Sotomayor piped up that she has a whole list of items that conflict with some people's religious views.
Biographical material about women who have been recognized for achievements outside of their home, divorce, interfaith marriage, or in modest dress.
Indeed, that kind of rule, interjected Kagan, would allow opt-outs for almost anything. Justice Barrett pressed Baxter on his failure to draw any line. At what point, she asked, is the school district imposing a burden on religious parents? Is it the mere exposure to ideas or something more? And Justice Jackson asked whether parents should be free to opt out their kids from a class if a gay teacher keeps his wedding photo on his desk. Representing the school board, lawyer Alan Schoenfeld fielded relentless incoming ammo from the court's conservatives. Justices Alito, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch were the most vociferous. Kavanaugh noted that he had been raised in Montgomery County, and he pressed lawyer Schoenfeld as to why opt-outs are not feasible. Schoenfeld replied, "This isn't like a healthcare and sexuality class where a student can opt out of the whole class," he said. "In grade school, students operate very differently. They can pull books from the shelves, read them to each other, or ask the teacher about the book."
It's mayhem, and the ability of teachers to manage the line between what is curriculum content coming directly from the teacher and coming indirectly from the sort of socialization in the classroom, I think, is very hard to draw.
Justice Alito was not satisfied.
Basically, your answer is it's just too bad.
My answer is that the school board here is democratically elected. The entire process of adopting this curriculum is open and transparent.
A decision in the case is expected by summer. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
A string of protests has targeted tech billionaires in several West Coast cities, but not the kind with large signs and marches. Instead, crosswalk speakers have been hacked with what appears to be satirical impressions of the billionaires. Casey Martin from KUOW in Seattle reports.
When you want to cross the street, you press a button, a little robotic voice tells you to wait, and then it says when it's safe to cross.
Walk sign is on. Crossing anyway.
But last week in Seattle, at least five intersections played something like this.
Hi, I'm Jeff Bezos. This crosswalk is sponsored by Amazon Prime with an important message. You know, please don't tax the rich. Otherwise, all the other billionaires will move to Florida, too.
That may sound like Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, but tech experts say it's likely AI. According to the Seattle Department of Transportation, these crosswalk signals were hacked to play these messages. Seattle wasn't the only place this happened. In Silicon Valley, it was reported that some crosswalk signals played recordings that sounded like Meta's Mark Zuckerberg and Tesla's Elon Musk. Amazon, Meta, and Tesla did not respond to requests for comment. Ava Pakstad heard one of the recordings at a crosswalk in Seattle's University District.
It's really funny, I think.
J.P. Smith also heard a U-District recording and said he agreed with the anti-billionaire sentiment.
I really appreciated it. I thought it was wonderful.
One of these signals is close to Amazon's headquarters, where many people who work for the company didn't want to comment. But Maceon Mace works at a restaurant close to Amazon HQ, and he's not a fan of the crosswalk prank.
If our cross signs could be hacked, anything could be hacked.
It isn't clear who's responsible. Seattle's Department of Transportation didn't offer an explanation of who did this or how, but said in a statement it is working with the crosswalk button vendor to strengthen security. David Kohlbrenner, who co-directs the Security and Privacy Research Lab at the University of Washington, says this probably wasn't very difficult to do.
They're not very secured. That's on purpose. They're usable by people out in the field, and so they don't want them to have a lot of complexity with interacting with them.
He says each crosswalk signal can be logged into with a phone app and Bluetooth. That makes it easy for the city to quickly fix a signal or update the audio at a specific crosswalk. All you need is the password to log in. He thinks what may have happened in this case is that the signals had the default password from the manufacturer, which is usually simple and easy to guess.
So if you don't change the initial password, then you would just be able to walk up, connect to the device, and then upload a sound file that you would like.
In December, a similar thing happened when a construction road sign was hacked to display an anti-CEO message.
There's a lot of infrastructure that works like this that is not designed for somebody malicious to come after it. And we rely on people being kind of reasonable citizens to not do that.
When it comes to the AI tech that likely made this stunt possible, Cecilia Aragon says it's also pretty simple. She researches AI-generated audio at the University of Washington.
All they need to do is have recorded samples of this person's voice. So basically anybody who's been recorded and is a semi-public figure is vulnerable to this type of fakery.
Aragon says it's called voice cloning. With just a few audio samples, AI can learn a person's speech patterns, accent, inflection, and then
composer in a different way. They rebuilt some of his brain. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports.
The composer Alvin Lucia was known for experimental works that explored the physical properties of sound. He strapped sensors to his forehead to transform his own brainwaves into a piece for percussion instruments and mined the resonance of everyday objects like pencils. Lucia died in 2021 at the age of 90, but the composer, or rather a surrogate created out of biological matter taken from his body with his permission before he died, is now putting out new music. Lucia Lucia's posthumous composition comes from a new installation at the Art Gallery of Western Australia in Perth called Revivification. Artist Nathan Thompson is one of its creators.
We have developed a brain on a dish, more or less, that has the ability to take action in the real world.
This brain on a dish takes the form of two small white blobs on a pedestal at the gallery. The blobs are a cluster of neurons that mimic in a very basic way the structure and development of a human brain. Thompson says it was grown out of stem cells created from blood samples the composer agreed to donate to the project the year before he died.
He was aware of possibilities that the work would perform for him even after his death.
Lucia's in vitro.
A video about the Revivification installation describes how the blobs, aka Alvin Lucia's surrogate self, make new music.
Surrounding this are 20 handcrafted brass plates.
These plates are attached to the walls like paintings. Also connected to the brain matter, they respond to its neural signals in real time with sound.
Revivification proposes a provocative vision of artistic immortality and speculates that Lucia's creative essence persists beyond death.
Creativity has two components.
Indre Viscontis is a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of San Francisco who studies creativity.
One is the originality or the novelty or the uniqueness of the piece, and here, of course, that's in spades.
But Viscontis says the blobs lack the other component that would make them capable of the creativity needed to truly make new art, intention.
Creativity really has to have a conscious element to it, and I don't think this particular piece of art is conscious. Those cells have no intention.
Yet, she says, even though this block of cells doesn't capture Lucia's creative essence, it's powerful because the composer was a partner in the creation of the piece. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Pope Francis made what he called the climate crisis a recurring theme during his papacy. He was the first pope to take the name of St. Francis of Assisi, the patron saint of animals and ecology. NPR's Jeff Brady looks at Francis's climate legacy.
Pope Francis's 2015 encyclical, or papal letter, on human-caused climate change did not mince words. Quote, "The earth, our home, is beginning to look more and more like an immense pile of filth." That September, the Pope was in the United States and delivered a message of urgent action with then-President Barack Obama.
Climate change is a problem we can no longer be left to a future generation.
Francis's climate encyclical was called in Latin Laudato Si, or Praise Be to You. It laid out how humans are changing the climate. It called on rich countries to help poorer ones and inspired new organizations to form, including the Global Catholic Climate Movement. Rebecca Elliott is with the group now called Laudato Si Movement.
All around the world, you saw all of these people reading the encyclical, writing letters to the editor, posting on social media, forming discussion groups in their parishes.
Elliot says her group trained about 20,000 people in 140 countries to organize tree plantings, litter cleanups, and marches for new climate policies. She says Latin America has been active. Pope Francis was born in Argentina. Elliot says bishops in Ecuador successfully campaigned for a 2023 vote to block drilling in the Amazon rainforest.
And the Catholic Church stood alongside indigenous leaders, young people, and others to support the referendum to stop oil extraction in Yasuni National Park.
Elliot says now bishops in Brazil are teaching parishioners about climate change ahead of the next United Nations Climate Conference happening there in November. In recent years, climate messages from scientists have become more urgent. Pope Francis's words have matched that. In 2023, he issued another papal letter.
He is evidently annoyed that much of humanity seems to have missed the message.
Fordham University theology professor Christiana Zenner says Francis included more science and outlined the problem more succinctly, like a professor whose students didn't get the lesson the first time. Researchers such as Ashley Landrum at Arizona State University have studied whether Francis's climate messages changed opinions.
What we found was the Pope did not change people's minds about climate change. The Pope changed people's minds about himself.
She says he was mostly preaching to the converted. Politically liberal people loved Pope Francis's climate messages, while conservatives, even conservative Catholics, were not swayed. Still, Landrum says he did plant a flag by showing that acting on climate change is consistent with socially conservative Catholic values. Zenner, the Fordham professor, thinks Francis's work on climate will have a lasting effect on the Catholic Church.
I think the Catholic Church now has to be seen as an entity that is concerned about care for creation and people's faith lives. I don't think that can be erased.
Around the world, more than 8,000 families, schools, groups, dioceses, and other organizations have pledged to take actions in response to Francis's climate encyclical. Now, researchers will watch to see how much attention a new pope gives to the problem of human-caused climate change. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Before World War II, some 11 million people spoke Yiddish, the historic language of Ashkenazi Jews. The language nearly disappeared because of the Holocaust and assimilation. But experts are quelling, as they say the language is showing some chutzpah and making a comeback. Robin Estrin from member station KCRW tells us why.
At a Jewish cultural center on the 14th floor of an old bank building in downtown Los Angeles, Rabbi Zach Golden is reading a poem called California. Golden translates from Yiddish.
I drift into sleep, becoming a desert dream.
This space, a hybrid synagogue and Jewish bookstore, is called Der Nister.
Der Nister means the hidden in Yiddish.
Golden co-founded it in 2020 as a center for Yiddish language and cultural events in Los Angeles. He says their events are drawing bigger crowds.
This may have been the first time this amount
of young people have showed up to such a thing in like 10, 15 years.
This interest in Yiddish boomed nationwide during the pandemic, says Sarah Bunin Benor. She's the director of the Jewish Language Project at Hebrew Union College.
There was a very strong spike in interest in Yiddish, in learning Yiddish online, in participating in Yiddish activities and Yiddish conversation groups and Duolingo and Yiddish Wordle.
Duolingo, the language learning platform, said by email that more than 360,000 people around the world are studying Yiddish on the app today. About half are under 30 years old. What's happening is radical, because a majority of the 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust were Yiddish speakers.
Yiddish then becomes associated with death.
Aaron Paley is the founder of an LA-based organization for preserving Yiddish culture called Yiddishkeit.
So it becomes, just by default, almost a negative thing to talk about Yiddish and to speak Yiddish. And it's not something then that the Jews are proud of.
Yiddish experts say most Jews in America assimilated and learned English, though for some ultra-Orthodox Jews, it remains the language of daily life. Meanwhile, Israel adopted Hebrew, not Yiddish, as an official language. All of that contributed to its decline. Years ago, when Zach Golden wanted to learn the language of his ancestors, he says he was discouraged.
I distinctly remember saying I was going to go learn Yiddish in the middle of rabbinical school and being told it was a waste of time.
Now, those who promote and study Yiddish say people are coming back to the language for different reasons. Some Jews are hungry to connect with their heritage. Golden wanted to speak to his bubby and reclaim the culture the Nazis tried to scrub away.
By knowing ourselves, our history, our language, our culture, that's knowledge is power.
Others who are critical of Israel want to explore Jewish identity outside of Zionism. That's the case for Iris Malka Morel, who organized the poetry reading back in downtown LA.
Growing up in the US, like, we're really raised to believe that if you're Jewish, like, the place you go is Israel, and the culture you go to is there now. And Yiddish really is like a different alternative to that.
Zionist or anti-Zionist, Golden doesn't really care why everyone's here. He's just glad to see so many people excited about Yiddish. For NPR News, I'm Robin Estrin in Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At Progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the job.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.